Well, we are continuing our study through the book of Job this morning, and today we'll be looking at chapters 6 and 7. You remember that Job had three friends come to visit him, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And after they had heard of the catastrophic things that had taken, that had happened to Job, he lost all his material wealth, his servants were killed. All 10 of his children were killed. He was now stricken with a painful disease. And then at that point, they come to visit with him. When they first get there, they sit with Job in silence for 7 days. Job then is the first one to speak, and he curses the day of his birth when he speaks and wishes he were dead. Eliphaz then is the first of the friends to speak to Job. And though he speaks with some gentleness compared to the others that will come later, he assumes that since so many bad things have happened to Job, that must mean that there's sin in Job's life, and so therefore he's responsible ultimately. So that if he'll just seek the Lord, fear God, then everything will turn out fine. Eliphaz really has some good things, very good things to say about the Lord and about our responsibility to seek Him, about the need for us to receive discipline from Him and to grow from that. The problem is his assessment of Job is not really accurate. So in chapter 6 and 7, then, we find Job's response to that first discourse of Eliphaz. And we'll go through like we did last week and just kind of go through these chapter 6 and 7 kind of a section at a time and look at what Job has to say. And then we'll reflect on what Job has to say and come up with three lessons in particular for us to consider. So, Job's response to Eliphaz. We'll begin by looking at chapter 6, verses 1 through 7. Then Job answered, "Oh, that my grief were actually weighed and laid in the balances, together with my calamity. For then it would be heavier than the sand of the seas. Therefore my words have been rash. For the arrows of the Almighty are within me. Their poison my spirit drinks. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. Does the wild donkey bray over his grass? Does the ox low over his fodder? Can something tasteless be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg? My soul refuses to touch them. They are like loathsome food to me." So in these verses, Job begins his answer to Eliphaz, and he says that he has good reason to complain of all his troubles. Eliphaz implied that Job was overreacting to his trials. Job says, well, if you take my grief, and you got a scale, you put all the sands of the ocean on one side, and my grief on the other, my grief would outweigh the sands of the ocean. So he admits that his words have been rash, but he says, when you consider the context of my trials, he says, I don't think they've been unreasonable. He feels like the terrors of God are focused on him. And then Job gives some examples from nature. He said, donkeys don't bray, and he said, oxen don't bellow or low when all is well and they're eating. But when they don't have what they need, they let you know. Job is saying, that's why I'm complaining. Things are not well with me, and I'm letting you know. He then compares the counsel of Eliphaz with tasteless food that needs seasoning, but you have no seasoning, or the white of an egg, that basically some of that tasteless things that are not helpful. And so he felt like he has good reason to complain because Eliphaz's counsel has not been helpful. Look now at verses 8 through 13. "Oh, that my request might come to pass, and that God would grant my longing. Would that God were willing to crush me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off. But it's still my consolation, and I rejoice in unsparing pain, that I have not denied the words of the Holy One. What is my strength that I should wait, and what is my end that I should endure? Is my strength the strength of stones, or my flesh bronze? Is it that my help is not within me, and that my deliverance is driven from me?" So here Job continues to express his desire to die and be rid of this pain. Job reiterates his desire that God would hear this prayer, this desire, and would actually cut him off from life. And his concern is that if the pain continues, which is intense, If the pain continues, then his concern is he will be overwhelmed and will say things that he does not want to say. At this point, he has not denied the Lord. He has not blasphemed God. But his concern is if the pain continues, it's going to get to a point where he's afraid that that could happen. He doesn't want that to happen. So he says, my strength is not like the strength of a stone. My flesh is not bronze. In other words, I'm not, impenetrable. I'm not, I can't just withhold everything. He's recognizing weakness. And so really, that is his reasoning. He's saying why I'm asking God to take my life, because I don't want to curse God. And I'm afraid if it keeps getting this way, I'm just not sure that I'm strong enough to endure. Okay, look at verses 14 to 30 now. And these, he's actually now focusing on the three friends. For the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friend, so that he does not forsake the fear of the Almighty. My brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi, like the torrents of wadis which vanish, which are turbid because of ice, and into which the snow melts. When they become waterless, they are silent. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. The paths of their course wind along. They go up into nothing and perish. The caravans of Tema looked. The travelers of Sheba hoped for them. They were disappointed, for they had trusted. They came there and were confounded. Indeed, you have now become such. You see a terror and are afraid. Have I said something? Have I said, give me something, or offer a bribe for me from your wealth, or deliver me from the hand of the adversary, or redeem me from the hand of tyrants? Teach me, and I will be silent, and show me how I have erred. How painful are honest words. But what does your argument prove? Do you intend to reprove my words when the words of one in despair belong to the wind? You would even cast lots for the orphans and barter over your friend. Now please look at me and see if I lie to your face. Desist now, let there be no injustice. Even desist, my righteousness is yet in it. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern calamities? So in these verses, Job reproves his friends for their unkind treatment and unhelpful counsel. In these verses, Job begins to use the second person plural. So that's like I said, we know that he's actually addressing now the friends, the three friends. And of course, you'll remember Eliphaz is the only one who has spoken so far. But the implication here is that as Eliphaz has spoken, the other guys are like, yep, in agreement. He can tell, even though he's on their own, one guy has spoken, that they're all in agreement with what Eliphaz has said. So he's addressing all of them. He says a despairing man needs kindness from his friends to keep him from forsaking the Lord. He's expressed that concern in the earlier verses. I need your help to help me endure this so I can stay firm. And it's very accurate to say at this point, Job is really mad. Job is angry. And it's going to come out that way. He compares his friends to a wadi or a brook. And he says at certain times of the year, that wadi, that brook, as water in it, because of what happened at that particular season of the year. And so if you come by the brook at that time, you've got lots of water there in the desert. So it's a place to rest and refresh and drink. But if you come by at other times of the year, it's going to be dry. There's not going to be anything there. And he talks about caravans who will come along that way and expecting there to be water in that brook, and there is no water. And so they're disappointed because they were anticipating refreshment, and there have none. Job says, that's what you guys are like. He says, when you came, the idea is when you came, I was encouraged. These guys are going to help me. They're going to be a comfort. It's not been that at all. It's like that dried up brook. There's nothing there to refresh me. In verse 21, verse 21, he says, indeed, you have now become such, like that dried up wadi. You see a tear and are afraid. what he seems to be saying here is that they look at Job and his situation, and they're afraid. Doesn't say exactly what they're afraid of, but I think what you can see here, especially in light of the fact that they have an understanding that this is happening on Job because of apparently a secret sin, something that he's done. Well, I'm sure they don't have to look very far to recognize they have some secret sins. They have some things like that. If all this is happening to Job, I don't want this happening to me. So it's almost like there's an implication there that there's a terror that they see as they look at Job, but they don't want to think too much about it because then it's going to come back on them, at least in their thinking. It's interesting, Job says, have I asked you to give me something? No, he says, have I asked you guys to kind of pitch in and help me get my feet back on the ground, you know, financially? You know, have I asked you to gather up a posse and just go after the Sabaeans or just go after the Chaldeans and show those guys they can't get away with this kind of stuff? No, I haven't asked anything from you. I haven't asked you to raise funds for me, anything like that. Just want you to be there to help, and you're not doing that. You're no comfort at all. He says then, in verse 24, he says, I'm willing to hear. Teach me and I'll be silent. Show me where I've heard. I'm willing to hear. But he also says, basically, to this point, their arguments have proved nothing. That they have not been helpful. And then in his anger, he says, verse 27, you would even cast lots for the orphans and barter over your friend. Basically, what he's saying is that you're the kind of guys who take advantage of orphans and take advantage of friends who are vulnerable in some way. Now, surely that's an exaggeration. But Job is mad. And he's just saying these things, you know, to kind of to tell him, you guys have been no help at all. Actually, you're making things worse. Look at chapter 7 now. Look at the first 6 verses. Is not man forced to labor on earth, and are not his days like the days of a hired man? As a slave who pants for the shade, and as a hired man who eagerly waits for his wages, so am I allotted months of vanity, and nights of trouble are appointed me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? But the night continues, and I am continually tossing until dawn. My flesh is clothed with worms and a crust of dirt. My skin hardens and runs. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and come to an end without hope. In these verses, Job reflects on the misery of his life. He compares his life to a hired man who's been working hard and he's just looking to get paid and rest and just take it easy. That's just what he's looking for. He's quite just speaking of his life in that sense. He's just ready to just rest, just for it to be over and done. And then he begins to describe his misery. He says, at night, when he tries to sleep, he can't sleep. And all through the night, he's just wishing that the morning would come. Finally, the morning comes. And then he's just wishing that the day will be over so he can get to the night, so he can get some sleep. And just back and forth, you know, just kind of just enduring. Then he talks about kind of the, once again, gives us some insight into the pain, the things that are happening on his body to kind of explain why he can't sleep, you know, from a physical perspective. He talks about his sores and that the worms in his sores. He talks about there's places where they've hardened over, the places where the pus apparently has broken again, burst again, and he's got you know that runs on his body. He said it's just, and we know from early on that he's got those sores from the top of his head to the soles of his feet. That's happening all over his body. In verse 6, interesting, he says in verse 6, he talks about how fast his days go. He compares them to, what was the word he said there? My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. Talking about just when they would weave and make carpets and so forth. And the shuttle, I think, is the part, you know, it just kind of would move back and forth as they're actually working and doing the different strands of the carpet. And he says, my days are like, they just keep, he said like that. So it's like, so this kind of seems like a contradiction. First he's saying everything just drags on. But then I look at it and it's like it just kind of seems like it's going so fast. And so it's so that you can just sense this, just this frustration, this confusion, this irritation, discouragement, all these things all together. He's in pain. And so his words don't always fit together. He's just kind of saying, here's what I feel. The next paragraph, verses 7 through 10, really build on what he says in verse 6. He says, remember that my life is but breath. My eye will not again see good. The eye of him who sees me will behold me no longer. Your eyes will be on me, but I will not be. When a cloud vanishes, it is gone. And so he goes down to Sheol. He who goes down to Sheol does not come up. Here it seems that once again the tense of the pronouns is now second person singular. So it seems now that he's now addressing Eliphaz, you know, with these particular words, just by virtue of what the tense is. So we see here that Job speaks to Eliphaz about the brevity of life. Like I said, he builds on what he says in verse 6. In verse 6, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. And so here in verse 7, he says, life is but a breath. In verse 9, he says it's like a cloud that's there and then just dissipates and vanishes and it's gone. So that's what life is like. He knows that death is going to come. You die once and then you're gone. And he clearly is looking forward to death and sees nothing wrong, really, and wishing that death would come quickly. Okay, the final verse of chapter 7, Job now speaks directly to God. So this is verses 11 through 21. Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or the sea monster that you set a guard over me? If I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you frighten me with dreams and terrify me by visions, so that my soul would choose suffocation, death rather than my pains. I waste away. I will not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are but breath. What is man that you magnify him and that you are concerned about him, that you examine him every moment and try him every moment? Will you never turn your gaze away from me, nor let me alone until I swallow my spittle? Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target, so that I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me, but I will not be. So these final verses, Job addresses God directly for the first time and complains of being treated unfairly. Verse 11, you can see the spirit with which he is speaking to God. He says, I'm not going to restrain my mouth. I'm going to speak out of the anguish of my spirit. I'm going to complain in the bitterness of my soul. Once again, you see the anger is not just at the friends. The anger is at God as well. Bitterness of soul. He recognizes the reason that he has not died is because God has set a guard over him. Of course, he's already mentioned that earlier about there being a hedge around him. He knows that's what's keeping him from dying. It's God who's keeping him from dying. He recognizes that, but then he complains because he says he's going back to this problem of not being able to sleep. There he talks about the physical problem of it because of the suffering that makes it where he just can't get comfortable and he can't sleep. But then he says, when I do lay down and rest, he says, God, you send nightmares to terrify me. Things are so bad, he says, I would rather be suffocated or strangle to death and continue in this pain. He then speaks again of the brevity of life and asks God to leave him alone so he can die. Verse 17 is interesting. He says, what is man that you magnify him and that you are concerned about him? This verse is very similar to another verse in the Bible, which is Psalm 8, verse 4, where David speaks. And David says, what is man that you take thought of him and the son of man that you care for him? Similar idea there, but their application is completely opposite. Because what David says, David speaks of just the wonder that God has, in a sense, exalted man and worked in man and been so gracious to man as he has. He's just amazed at what God has done just for lowly man. But Job's application is this. Once again, Job says, what is man that you magnify him, that you are concerned about him? Job's application is, why are you examining me so carefully, so closely? leave me alone. Why do you look so in such detail to see what's going on in me? He says, you just scrutinize me to the point. He's accusing God of gazing and watching him really with like you might call an evil eye, treating him cruelly. In verse 20, he says, why have you set me as your target? And then he closes his address to God. But he admits as he closes that he has committed transgressions and that he needs God to take those transgressions away, to take away his iniquity. It seems that he's, as he is thinking of his death, first, and he's speaking to God, not in the best of terms, to say the least, seems to be recognizing the fact that there are sins here that I need to make sure are right, as I recognize that maybe God will answer my prayer and I will die. So he realized he still has things that need to be forgiven. Now, as we consider this discourse of Job, there's a number of things I want us to focus on, lessons. We could speak of a number of things here. But these are three things that really stood out to me the most and I think would be helpful for us to talk about a little bit. So some lessons to be learned from Job's response. One of the things that's an obvious characteristic of what Job says here is his anger. What do we learn from Job's anger? Well, I would say it this way. There is a place for anger in the Christian life, but there's also a great danger to be avoided. Before we look at the place of anger, I want to point out the danger that's in anger. So first point we'll say is this. Most anger is sinful and foolish. Most of the time, anger is sinful. Most of the time, it's foolish. To illustrate that, I just want to read some verses from the book of Proverbs that are very descriptive in talking about this. Proverbs 29:11 says, a fool vents all his feelings, but a wise man holds them back. A fool vents all his feelings. Chapter 25:28. Whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls. Kind of with the venting, just kind of let everything come out. Which, by the way, you'll note, this is something that psychiatrists say is a good thing to do. You need to vent. You need to let everything out. Proverbs says if you do that, you're a fool. You have to figure out who's right. I think Proverbs is right. Chapter 19, verse 11, the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and his glory is to overlook a transgression. Slow to anger. Chapter 29, verse 20, do you see a man hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than for him. If he's hasty in words, which anger has a tendency to go with being hasty in your words. Chapter 29, verse 22, an angry man stirs up strife, and a furious man abounds in transgression. If a man has a reputation for anger, transgression is going to go along with that. He who is quick-tempered acts foolishly, and a man of wicked intentions is hated. Quick-tempered acts are foolish acts. He who is slow to wrath has great understanding, but he who is impulsive exalts folly. Chapter 15, verse 18. A wrathful man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger allays contention. Once again, the emphasis on being slow to anger, not stirring things up. Chapter 19, verse 19. A man of great wrath will suffer punishment, for if you deliver him, you will have to do it again. And then last one I would mention here. This would be a good application if, and I'm going to especially apply this to single ladies who have, you know, you're in the opportunity comes, somebody shows an interest in you as far as a husband. This would be a good thing to have on your checklist and say, whoops, no. Proverbs 22:24-25, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. The person you're considering has a reputation for anger. Stay away. So, lots of warnings. Lots of warnings about anger. Most anger is sinful, like I said. And the scripture there says most anger would be considered foolish. Now, we talked about how I mentioned how, you know, that it's sometimes counseled that giving vent to anger is something to kind of purge the system, so to speak, to help you. So Job gave vent. Job is doing some venting here. This is a hard figure. There's a hard line you'll see as we're going through here to try to figure out what part of what Job said was okay and what was not okay. And I don't think we can get real specific here. But before we actually look into this, to the positive aspect of anger, I wanted to emphasize the negative aspect of anger. And we need to keep that warning in mind as we look at this second point. So what does proper anger look like? Number two, proper anger must be righteous anger. A couple places, Ephesians 4:26, Paul told the Ephesians, he says, be angry, but don't sin. He also says, don't let the sun go down on your anger. There's a place for being angry, but in your anger, don't sin. Once again, Proverbs said, that's a hard line to follow. Paul says, there's a place for anger, but don't make sin be a part of it. So you're going to have to be careful there. Jesus drove out the money changers out of the temple. He was angry. He was very angry. We're told in John 2:17 why he did that. He said it was zeal for the house of God that consumed him. In other words, he was so consumed with the glory of God and for the honor of the Lord, and he realized that the Lord was not being honored with what was taking place there in the temple. And so that's why he did what he did, and that's why he was angry. That was righteous anger. So where does Job fit here? Like I said, that's a hard question. What was Job angry about? We can probably sum up in a couple of different things. I think he was angry really because of his physical pain and the condition he was in now. I mean, he's racked with pain. He's living out by the garbage dump. He can't do really anything, hardly, that he was able to do before. And so there's all these physical limitations and the pain. There's just this sense of it that he can't do what he used to do. And he's angry because of what can't even sleep. He feels like life is futile. It's not going to get any better. What's the use of planning for the future? There's not going to be any future. This is it, and it's not going to get any better. He knows he's going to die someday. So why not now? You know, Lord, just end my life. Just stop it here. In a sense, he's saying, why me? And I think most of us, as we kind of read and have some idea of what he was going through, could understand why somebody would say and ask that kind of, why? Why is this happening? Why is this going on? Why is this persisting? I think we can understand that question. Job also feels he's been treated unfairly. He mentions he's not been treated fairly by his friends. They've not been a comfort in his situation. He feels that God's treating him unfairly. He's in the final verse of chapter 7, Job wants God to leave him alone so he can die. It's kind of like, what have I done to you? It's an interesting verse, and I'm not even sure really how Job meant it at the end of chapter, the very last phrase of chapter 7, verse 21. He says, from now on I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me, but I will not be. I think some say you will not find me. Basically, what Job seems to be saying here, when I'm dead, you're going to miss me when I'm gone. And I don't know if that's sarcasm because you won't have anybody to pick on anymore, or if he actually is acknowledging the fact that he knows God cares about him. So it's an interesting phrase. I don't know exactly all that he means there. Like we said, Job is angry. Well, how much of this is righteous anger? Well, I think it's hard to draw a clear line. This quote by Matthew Henry, I think, is helpful. He says, we must not go to school to Job, here to learn how to speak to God. For it must be confessed, there is a great mixture of passion and corruption in what he here says. But if God be not extreme to mark what his people say amiss, let us also make the best of it. He says, don't look for this as a guide on how to pray. There is such a mixture here of wrong passions and even some misunderstandings that we're going to look at here in a moment. So he says, don't use this as a model. At best, it's a mixture. The positive thing here is all the way through, Job is interacting with God. He actually is praying. He's bringing the deepest pain. I mean, not just physical, but emotional and spiritual pain that he's feeling. He's bringing all that to the Lord. He never denies the Lord. He never denies his faith, and he wants to make sure that that never happens. So there's some positive things here as he's engaging. But like Matthew Henry also said, even though he's not the best of examples here, he says, if God be not extreme to mark what his people say amiss, let us make the best of it. So it seems that God's allowing Job to speak this way. Let me give you a couple, just once again, this lesson is probably the least descriptive of the others we're going to look at. But you can almost look at it from two angles, I think. First off, if you're from Job's angle, from the person who is actually feeling the rage or the anger, when we put that in context with the warnings, don't come to the place where you feel like it's okay to say anything you want to say to anyone. There still needs to be restraint. And we still need to be aware. I mean, because even Job, there's still some restraint. He doesn't want to go as far as denying God or, just even calling into doubt his existence or anything of that sort, his faith. So there's still an angle. What I would counsel is really similar to what the first lament that Job prayed. Like I said then, there is a place for lament in the Christian life. If I were you, I would use the scriptural laments and the Psalms as a guide instead of just making up your own, and you can kind of maybe ad lib some of the things, but at least have a guide there. The other angle to look at is for the person who's listening. Because I would think, it would be hard to sit here and listen to Job say these things and say, all right, I hear your pain. It would be hard to hear this. So from the perspective of the one who is listening, the one who is hearing this, I think there is the place of give some grace, give some room, try to find out what's going on, why they're feeling this way. So I think there's application from a couple different angles here. I think that's the most I know to say, so we'll just leave it at that. Second lesson is this. It is true that both good and adversity come from the hand of God, but God never acts toward believers as if they are his enemies. He never acts toward believers as if they are his enemies. If you remember back at the beginning, Job chapter 2, verse 10, he said, shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? And all this Job did not sin with his lips. What he said was correct. It was right. So both good and adversity come from God. He clearly brings blessing into our lives. He also sends, or at least allows, adversity to come into our lives. Bad things. We saw in early chapters that the context here, of course, is that God is the one who is sending these calamities, but Satan is actually the messenger who actually brings them. So that's the context that we have here. So Job rightly believes that God is sovereign, even over the adversity that he's dealing with right now. But it's also clear that Job's understanding of what's going on is extremely limited. And that's a big part of what's happening in this part of the book of Job, is that Job is wrestling with trying to understand these things, trying to understand what's going on and why it's going on, and